The White Network presents Saturday Afternoon with Carolyn. Your host, Carolyn Yeager.
Hello and welcome on this Saturday, March 22nd, 2014. We're in the busiest time of the year and on the internet, as far as my experience tells me, March, April, and May. Ladies and gentlemen, I am using a different mic, a headset tonight, and in order to check my sound levels. As I'm looking, it's slowly getting a little bit louder, and I don't even know if I have this mic set on the right setting, but I want to get a little feedback from someone. I think probably Tan is listening, is if I sound all right. Not only my sound level, but the that's gone way up again. It didn't take as long this time, but it did start out a little bit slow, and I don't know if I'm too loud or it seems like I'm maybe just about right. I might be, I can't quite tell. It goes down and then it comes back up. Well, as I said, I think I'm all right. We're in the busiest time of the year on the internet. I wanted to mention that because, I wanted to say that my website, CarolynYeager.net, is going great guns. I've never had so many reads to my posts that I can even recall as I've had in the last couple of weeks, maybe more than that. I very quickly get 100 reads to everything I post. Doesn't take that long, and then it keeps going up. On some, well, some of course go up more than others, but I'm real pleased with that. And I wanted to mention that the just published November 1943 to February 1944 installment of Leopold Wenger's letters, the first ones from the Eastern Front, is over 200 reads already. I don't know what it'd be right now. And the previous installment of his letters from Sicily, which I published 1 month ago, is almost 1400 reads at this time. So, and I'm giving you accurate data from the server. I don't pretend that I get thousands of visitors a day to my site, but I think that's very good for a website such as mine, which is only me working and never done anything special to put links all around or post all around to get people to come to my site. So I appreciate those who find it valuable. And I also don't pick up and repost things from the internet very often, unless I think it's something really special, which would, you know, the more you post on your site, the more new things there are, the more people want to come and see what's new there. But I don't have things, if I have one new thing a day, that's about all I manage there, and maybe a few new things a week, sometimes more. But people do come to see what's going on there, and I'm really pleased. I hope that this increase continues. I guess it's up to me whether it continues or not. All right, I'm having a little trouble getting used to this headset I'm wearing because my voice sounds very different to me. I like my standing mic, but it seems like it possibly might be why there's some kind of problem in it. I'll have to get a new one. Because I like that setup much better, and I have some nice separate earphones than this all-in-one thing. I hear myself much better than I do with that, which I sound different there. But anyway, it seems to be working all right. So I mentioned that I'm really happy to get a good response to the Leopold Wenger letters. There's at CarolynYeager.net. There's a lot of work involved in making this material available. there's a lot of work, been a lot of work for Willie Wenger, in supplying me with everything and answering questions and so on. And we've been doing this for quite a while, and he's very good about it, but he's over 85 and he's not in the best health. So it's an effort for him, but he's really good. He's really good about it, does the best he can. And, then for the translator, a lot of work, and I've gone through quite a few translators with that already, and they get tired of it after a while. Now I've got Carlos Porter, who's been just wonderful, and he's going to continue to the end. So, and the end is in sight. So, but there's still a bit more to come. So that's a relief to me. He's done naturally. He does a lot of work all the time. He's a real worker, and he does it because he believes in this period of time and in the German side of the war and all of these things. And so he does it out of his sense of duty and wanting to help the cause of truth in this area. So that's good. And then it takes a lot of time of my time, huge amount of time. It might look easy to just go get something from somebody, have it translated and plop it down there. But it takes me a long time to get the formatting right, and especially to put in the photographs and to keep track of the photographs, because they're all labeled in German, and some of the labels are very brief, and that's where I have to keep checking and finding things out and getting all the ones in the right place, because I'm a fiend for accuracy, and I just moved some around in this last one I posted. A couple days after I posted it, I added a photograph that I had intended to use, and then I thought, no, it wasn't labeled right, and it didn't really belong there, but it turned out that it did. So by the time even after I posted it for a few days, I finally got everything straightened out and cleared up, and I understand it all myself. So there it is for you, and I hope you will take a look at all of these installments in the Wenger family, spelled W-E-N-G-E-R, on the side, right-hand sidebar at carolynyager.net, and see if there's anything there you might have missed. Now, I also want to thank some contributors today who helped make this possible, who helped make this radio program, these radio programs possible is what I mean to say. and today they are Richard from Chicago, Dimitar from Ontario, Canada, and Elizabeth from the United Kingdom. Now, how's that for geographical variety? I like that geographical variety we get here. So today my topic is In Defense of National Socialism, and I came up with that in thinking about how to talk about what's going on today with Vladimir Putin in Russia and in regard to the Ukraine and all of that. And I was not trying to carefully follow that at all in the beginning, because I was into some, a lot of work of things that I needed to do and I was working on, and it just didn't give me much, any time for that. So I've caught up a little bit, because a lot of what happens, you don't really know what's going on, and you read a whole bunch of stuff, and then it all changes, and if things, it takes a while for things to kind of the reality to be sifted out from all the talk and hubbub. I have to say that the only thing I have to say about it now is that I like Putin too. I find him a very attractive character and person and leader. And, I always, kind of liked him. And when you'd read bad things about him, I'd be a little bit, not wanting to believe that, or, you know, but I didn't have that strong of feelings about it. But he certainly has a lasting quality he's been in power there for a long time. He's very popular and he's done a lot of good things. And I find him also physically attractive. He's attractive as a man, and that's always a plus. He seems like a real man, and he's got a good demeanor about him, where you feel like he's serious and also good. You get the impression that he's good, and a lot of impressions. But right now, I wanted to, what I said in my announcement, that here we have, it seems to be a kind of a strange thing to me. Here we have all these people who, I wish, when I say all these people, okay, I'm talking about internet sites that are of the type that are nationalist and, pro-white people, pro-white, our kind of sites, all right? And where there are comments, you find a lot of people, a lot of commenters who will say in one way or another, it'll come out that they consider themselves national socialist. And some of them go all out for it, and a lot of these people don't use real names. You don't know who they are, but sometimes you know their identity on the internet. So that's enough of an identity, basically, because there's some consistency with them. So we have all these, national socialists who right now are saying, Heil Vladimir, you know, and, Heil, Putin, and going all out for Putin and believing that, he is, someone who we can turn to or we can feel comfortable with, and he will take us where we want to go. And all this national socialism amongst commenters on websites has kind of concerned me. I don't feel, I have different feelings about it, but you know, I suppose sometimes a little irritated or something, by it, when it seems kind of, sometimes it seems superficial. That would be the thing. It often seems very superficial to me. And, so it's okay, you know, but, I don't think these people are all that I think they're following along and wanting to fit in, a lot of them, or they want to think they are, National Socialist, but it's never been put to the test, and it has not, they have not been put to the test on it, so they might change their mind, depending. And this is a case where it seems like a lot of people are kind of changing their mind, and yet I have to say that that you cannot be National Socialist and pro-Russian, I don't think, considering all that means right now, at the same time. So not that you would be anti-Russian. I'm not, against Putin. As I said, he's the best. He looks better than anybody else. He behaves better than anybody else. He seems to be better than anybody else on the world stage right now. That is true. But, there are other things to be considered here. So I'm going to, just point out what National Socialism really stands for to begin with, and then see how that fits in with Vladimir Putin and what he's been saying. So the first thing is that it's racial. National Socialism is based on racial ideas and racial beliefs. Number one, and it's Germany was always Germany for Germans. And, that's what they call race, that, you know, they call being German race, Blut und Boden, blood and soil, and there's a connection there. So only a German can be a German, and they didn't want too many non-Germans in Germany, enough, you know, certain amount of visitors and so on, and, laborers, workers, different things, that reasons why people would come. but not to become, not to become part of the nation if they weren't German blood. And number two item that I have is that no Jews. You know, Jews were not really welcome, and particularly, you know, in the beginning, there was no Jews ruling over Germans. No Jews controlling German industry, culture, or education, anything important. There could be some Jews there, but not Jews that had important positions where they would be influencing what happened in Germany and to Germans. Now, third was no Bolshevism. They came after the Jews, I suppose, were pretty much, you know, in the same, very, very similar, but, Bolshevism had taken over the trade unions. The communists had done very well amongst the workers. So that had to be dealt with, but they wanted a system of, fairness for workers, but without, the trade unions that had been developed up till then because they were full of communists. Now, four is just the Volkish culture. That's a part of National Socialism. You're going to have everything for the folk. And you believe in Germans. You're positive about Germans and about German history and German development of the German people and so on. And this was all considered important to keep in mind. Then five is... And all these things are intertwined very much, keeping racial purity by passing laws for that purpose. That's pretty much the same as the first one, but you know, it brings in that, that they had laws and they legalized it. They put it in the code that, racial purity was necessary for Germans to support with their own lives and so on. So now we look at Putin, and as to the first item, race, well, he is and he isn't. I mean, it's hard to tell what he's doing there. He's for the Russians, but he often has a wider idea of who is Russian, of who can be Russian. It doesn't seem to emphasize race so much. And number two, yeah, he does have some history of getting rid of the Jews and of taking Jews out of power. And that's very, very good. You know, I mean, I think he's done better there than just about anybody. But then there are some Jews he doesn't. He allows. I mean, it's not across the board. And then three, communism, rather than being against communism, his loyalty to his nation causes him to seek for respectability for communism. Not to become communist again, but to respect that period of time and respect the Russians who were involved, in a sense, you know, not because right after the end of the Soviet Union, communism was pretty much disrespected, and now he's changed that. And I don't know if he started the change, but he's been around for a long time, and anyway, it has changed. Number four, I don't know. Volkish culture is what I talked about under National Socialism, and I don't know if the Russians emphasis on traditional Russian culture, and he supports that, but I don't know that he instigates it or that he's got it as a policy of his government, or if this is just people, Russian people who are doing it, and then it's publicized, but I don't know that. Now, talking of passing laws, okay, that's the fifth one. Keeping the laws, laws that insist on keeping racial purity, he doesn't, they don't have those laws, and racial purity is not mentioned ever by Putin, as far as I know. Of course, it's totally politically incorrect now. And he's a part of the, you know, the community of nations, of the important nations of the world. And he gets along with, he politically cooperates with the G7 or G8 or whatever it is, and also with the United Nations. And he expresses the proper concern for Jews and anti-Semitism in Israel. And I'll hold off on the next one. So you can say, and people do say, well, he has to do this. He's forced to do this. If he didn't, you know, well, he would be in trouble. Well, Hitler had to do it too, but he didn't do it. Now, you might say there's a little bit more at that time of around the world of nationalist feelings and racial feelings, certainly than there has been post-war. That's true. That's true. But Hitler pushed his way to the forefront of the parties and the political system in Germany, holding to his racial and anti-Jewish platform. Germany for Germans and anti-labor union, because they're all controlled by communists then, and the anti-Semitism. In fact, in 1921, he gave a speech titled "Why We Are Anti-Semites," and I was able to, through some help of a good friend to get hold of that speech, which I'd never been able to find, and he translated it, and we published it, and I posted it on my sites, and we did a show on it. But, you know, he never avoided that issue, which is what makes him and made him so unique and made him, of course, the target for the Jews and probably Putin. Does not want Russia to be a target of the Jews. And so he's, you know, you can say he's playing, he's playing smart politics. There's such a thing as called, real politic, where you have to realize what you can do and what you can't do. And in order to keep going for your, to, because you think you're better than others in accomplishing good goals for your country, you've got to kind of play along with things. All right, but then we come to the biggie, the Holocaust. Putin is a big defender of Holocaust. And he's not going to change because of the Russian position, the Russian position in the war and so on. He's a big defender of how good the war was. He doesn't care about the cost of it to the Western Europe or to the, you know, main Europe. He only thinks about the cost of it to the Russian people and what they sacrificed and so on. And that's how he sees it. And he's, and the Holocaust is real, embedded into all of that, believing in it. And I would just say that anyone who would say I'm a national socialist, but I think our next the leader we should look to now is Vladimir Putin, is forgetting about the Holocaust. You know, how do they deal with that? And also forgetting about caring about Western Europe and we Western Europeans those whose heritage is from there, based on the current needs, you know, based on how corrupt and degraded the Western leaders are and how anti-racist and so on. And they are, they're horrible. And yet they're all us people, here in the West and Anglo-American sphere, matter. And I don't think that we would matter so much let's say if we kind of crowned Vladimir Putin our leader and say, okay, take us away. We'll follow. Where would we be going and what would happen to our own homelands and, our own history, as we see it? Because the history as the Slavs see it can be, particularly Russia, can be very different in many ways in the history, our history as we see it. So now let me just say that, mention a few things here. Because that's the kind of the groundwork of what I had to say. Yabik, there's recently stories about Yabik and this Polish nationalist group, they call it. I don't know if I've got the right one. I didn't get back to that original story I saw, but I think this is the same one, which was on the 3rd of February. Of course, it's already in March, but so maybe something took place since then. But there were Hungarian Jobbik Party and a Polish national movement called Ruch Narodowy issued a joint statement and calling for their respective governments to immediately unite their efforts in applying their foreign and national political means to protect the rights of ethnic minorities living in Ukraine, with special regard for the Polish and Hungarian groups. Well, you know, it's kind of tame. But this Polish national movement, Ruch Narodowy, if that is the party that is supposed to be the most nationalist now and that Jobbik was making some agreement with, would a Polish nationalist movement or party ever change their position on Holocaust? Do you think that they, no matter, you know, what Polish nationalism would be, as we allow for every nation, would be in the interests of what they, or the interests of Poles, or as they see it? How do they see their own interests? Well, I don't think they're going to see it as changing their mind about Holocaust. And of course, people will say to me, the countries of the West are even worse about Holocaust. They're twice as bad or more than that than the Eastern European countries or Russia. So, Russia doesn't even go all out to imprison people and so on, do things like that, revisionists. So, what are you talking about, Carolyn? But I know that. I know our governments are terrible. I know we're no example, but there's still a lot of true patriots and true nationalists in the West, who are holding on to the truth about this and are willing to speak out and so on. Whereas I don't know whether any nationalists, that would be in the Slavic countries, say, talk differently about Holocaust than they have been doing all this time. Now, Hungary is not Slavic. And I'm not being anti-Slavic here. And I also want to, I don't want to be. I don't want to be. I'm not trying to be. But I want to say now, I should, that I do invite callers in the second hour to give your opinion, if you have an intelligent opinion. Not just an uninformed opinion, but call in and tell me where you think I'm wrong. And the number will be 830-443-4911. That's not till after the break. And then I'll be ready to answer calls. So I was saying that Hungary is not Slavic. Romania, another place where they are willing to question the Holocaust, some people are, and not go along with it so much and kind of resist. Romania is not Slavic either. I always thought it was, but I think there are Slavs there. I think it's mixed. And I'm not sure about that. But I believe it was, Dr. Vesserle that corrected me that when I was thinking that Romania was Slavic, he said, no, they're not. Not mostly. And of course, Finland is not. I don't know about Estonia, Lithuania, and Latvia now. I think they might be. But again, if anybody knows about that for sure or wants to look that up and call in the second hour or send me an email or something, we'll get that straight. But there's a lot of real patriots there who are anti-Russian and because of their experience with the Soviet Union. So I don't think there's something different than pure Slavic, but at least Estonia especially. Because for one thing, Putin was now talking about, I saw something that talking about the Russian minority in Estonia wanted to join with Russia. Today, you know, all this stuff is being stirred up. So, there's that. Okay, so we come down, you know, to how can a person be a real national socialist and go along with a lot of ideas that contradict that? And this brings up how serious people are when they say I'm a national socialist. Some are. Some understand what they're saying, and some are just, I think, joining along. And then some might be liars who are like trolls. because a lot of this goes on in comment sections. But there's a lot of activity in comment sections, and people get very involved in them and use them to learn from and discuss things and so on. So there's good and bad about everything. Now, I came across a story that was called Putin versus Hitler, that is not, I think it was from reading something else, is not too, in the Post Gazette, not too old, 2014, March 9th. Okay. It's by, I'm just going to pull out a few things from this, but it's by Charles Lane, who was a member of the Washington Post editorial board. But he was saying that historical analogizing in the wake of Vladimir Putin's strike on Ukraine is a risky business, but it's a growth industry. He says that everybody's doing it. Everybody's, you know, talking about this. And making analogies. And he says the mother of all analogies is the Hitler analogy. Hillary Clinton, although, you know, for me, like, who wants to repeat what she says? I don't care if she's going to be the next president of this poor battered country. I could care. I really can't take anything she says seriously. But, you know, she said that, she likened, Putin's invasion of, Crimea to Hitler's invasion, supposedly, of Czechoslovakia. So they have this, he says, this superficial comparison between the two men. But what he said, and then he says that as young men, both Hitler and Putin zealously served their countries on the front lines of international conflict. One was a German soldier, that was Hitler, on the Western Front, and the other was a Soviet KGB officer in East Germany during the Cold War. Well, I've got a little more to say about that in a little bit, but we'll get on to that more about who is Vladimir Putin as I come up to it. So then this Charles Lane says that each was cast adrift when the empire upon which they had staked their future collapsed, that is, the war for Hitler and the Soviet Union for Putin, which came to an end. And he has some quotes here from Putin. And I assume they're not wrong, but I don't know the context of them, see. And he says Putin has recalled the dramatic moment when he felt obliged to hide his Soviet Communist Party membership card in a desk drawer. I guess it's not something he wanted to do, but he felt that he, at some point he had to do. And I think I have something on that coming up. And then he said, he has also said that the collapse of the Soviet Union was a genuine tragedy for the Russian people. Well, when I first read that, I thought that had quite a bit of meaning, because he thought that, the Soviet Union was better for the Russian people. But that's really probably not the context. Was probably what he probably meant was that, at that point, suddenly everything changed and the society that people had known fell apart and gangsterism took hold. This is not what's said there, but, you know, and this gangsterism was really Jewish gangsters, but a lot of terrible things happened and the Russian people were just thrown for a loop one more time. I don't know how many times that's happened to the Russian people. I guess they're kind of used to it. Well, then the other thing I wanted to comment on was the latest article at the Occidental Observer by Michael Kohlhaas. And he is writing something in which he's admiring Putin. And these are my words. These are my words, my summing up of it. He admires Putin for accomplishing a lot, but which turns out to be only a little of what Hitler accomplished in Germany, and yet he despises Hitler and thinks well of Putin. I talked about Michael Kohlhaas before and his dislike of Adolf Hitler and National Socialism, which he calls Nazism. And he's openly a Christian. He wants a Christian society and so on. And I used to, when I first came upon him, I just loved him. And I was emailing with him he wrote these beautiful things because I believe he's German. I think he is, although now I can't say for sure, but I just assumed he was then. Kohlhaas is not his real name, and probably not Michael either. That's not his real name. So I don't know what his real name is, but I'm sure that he is German. He was writing wonderful things about Germany, but he then I saw that he makes an exception for Adolf Hitler, who he thinks was extremely damaging, and he hates everything about it, basically. He'll say that he started out doing good things, but then it went bad. Anyway, he writes that he lives now in this little town or little place in eastern Ukraine with his young wife. He calls her a young wife and child. He's not young. I don't know how old he is. But he's not young, but, he's getting out of the West. He was obviously went there to get away from the West, which he despises now, what's going on there and in Western Europe, what's going on. So he went there and he's been there for a few years and he writes and he posts things at the Occidental Observer. Whenever he has something, he's got a beautiful website, beautiful, gorgeous. He's quite an artist. He's got such a great artistic taste. I mean, he's just, it's, exceptional. But he talks about the Ukraine, or I should say Ukraine now, and he describes it as wages are pitifully low, but the people he puts it across that the people are happy, wages are pitifully low, bribes are a part of life, everybody's used to it. He says that he realized with this Ukrainian deal that there exists a deep divide that separates East and West. It means East and West Ukraine. They're two different languages, In the East, they speak Russian. In the West, they speak Ukrainian. And both tongues are rooted in Slav idiom. And I want to get through this pretty fast. He talks about Stalin's collectivization orders and that it was a gang of human monsters who efficiently managed to murder more than 20 million people, at least 6 million in the Ukraine alone, and the rest in Russia. And who they were murdering was independent farmers, ethnic minorities, members of the bourgeoisie, priests, senior officers, intellectuals, artists, labor movement activists, and opposition supporters at random. and even members of the Communist Party itself. And the, you know, that ended up with the Holodomor, which he says, was these, this NKVD gang of thugs who at ordered at gunpoint the Ukrainian farmers to surrender their winter provisions. And in due course, they first saw their children die of hunger and then died themselves. So he has no use for those people. But now he says, then he has to bring in Hitler and make Hitler out to be even worse somehow. He says, yet what is affected was an escalation of the tragedy, if that could be possible, because there arrived a day when Hitler set out to take with the fist what is refused to amicable methods, an intention long since heralded in Mein Kampf. And then he quotes from Mein Kampf, Hitler saying land can only be obtained at the expense of Russia, and this means that the new Reich must again set itself on the march along the road of the Teutonic Knights of old to obtain by the German sword soil for the German plow and so daily bread for the nation. And he says then the nation in question was, of course, exclusively meant to be Germany. And I say that's not true, because while they needed food and bread for Germans, they weren't going to starve their other people like the Soviets did. They had never had any intention to starve them, the people that they were going to be living with there. And in a sense, yes, ruling over. But anyway, that he said that the young Ukrainians and other men in Galicia and other parts of that area flocked to the Führer's heathen banners. He calls them heathen banners, and which was the swastika and so on, and wanted to fight because they thought they would go east and defeat these people who starved them to death and so on, and get revenge. But Kohlhaas says what came to pass was an even worse carnage that ended up in utter defeat at Stalingrad. And those who got caught alive paid dearly for their treason. Well, he's blaming Hitler for that he lost. They lost that battle, and those non-Germans who were in there also didn't get what they wanted out of this war, and they got caught by the Soviets, and then they paid dearly because they were especially maybe pointed out, picked out for treason against the Soviet Union. But anyway, this is all just his, he's just saying this. Then he goes on, you know, and talks about how great Putin has done, how much, growth and, well-being he's brought to the country, how the working people are better off. And I did find that in Wikipedia that, under Putin, the Russians have done better and better, and the average Russian has a better standard of living, and, you know, everybody's pretty happy there with him. So that's good. But then he says, that we don't, at this point, we don't know what's going on. And, that's where he writes about that quite a bit, and I'm not going into that. But I'm still working on the comparison between the two men and why, how people view them. Now, I looked up Putin, you know, and tried to get some information because I never really did that before. And I'll just cover it as fast as I can here, you know, that he was for 16 years an officer in the KGB, which doesn't bother me that much, but rising to the rank of lieutenant colonel, before he retired to enter politics in St. Petersburg in 1991. In 1996, he moved to Moscow, and he joined Boris Yeltsin's administration. He rose quickly, becoming acting president when Yeltsin resigned unexpectedly in 1999. And he subsequently won the 2000 election and was reelected, and then we know that he became vice vice president or something to Medvedev. And then when that his terms were up, Putin could run again, and he did. And now he's still in. So he's been in for quite a long time, basically ruling since the year 2000 then, 14 years. And in that time, it says, you know, that wages more than tripled, unemployment and poverty more than halved. Of course, those were some good years for everybody during that time. And then Russia has all those natural resources, which have been very helpful to any countries in the last 15 years or so that have these natural resources. So some of the things he did, but he's currently ranked as the world's most powerful person by Forbes magazine. Now, he joined the KGB in 1975 as soon as he graduated from university. Now, another thing that I'm going to start with, though, is that his father was a model communist, genuinely believing in the ideals of communism and trying to put them into practice in his own life. So while his mother was a Christian and, you know, faithfully went to the Orthodox Church and even kind of secretly had him christened in the church as an infant, we have to realize that he was raised by a totally believing communist father, so I had to have some influence on him. And that's probably why he always thought that was the right way and you know, didn't criticize it much. And when after he graduated from university, he went directly into the KGB. And there's, you know, he didn't do anything really outstanding. He obviously did his job, and he ended up in Dresden from 85 to 90. So he was in the KGB from 1975 to 1990, 15 years. In the last 5 years, he was in Dresden, and he was a part of illegal intelligence gathering unit, which is a classification for agents who used falsified identities. So he was working with these agents who had false identities, and he was given cover as a translator and interpreter. So I guess he speaks German. I'm not going to make too much out of that, except that when he resigned, he had the rank of lieutenant colonel, and it was on August 20th, 1991, and this was on the second day of the KGB-supported abortive putsch against Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev. So this putsch didn't succeed. But in the second day, he says he saw the writing on the wall or something, and he had to make a decision. He's quoted as saying, "As soon as the coup began, I immediately decided which side I was on." I assume he means he was going to be on those who were, I don't know. I'm not going to say. Though he also noted that the choice was hard because he had spent the best part of his life with the organs, or meaning the organization, I think. So, yeah, so his choice was to go against the KGB and to go for the new thing. I don't know, I can't say where everybody was on that, but he found it difficult to leave it behind. And I had said earlier that he was, you know, that he, where is that? I'm not going to be able to find it now. Anyway, that he thought that was, he at the point, time that came, that he felt he had to put his communist, what was it? His communist, ID thing into a desk drawer. And he took a side. Now, the other thing about him is that, Well, he talks about this. He supposedly had a religious awakening following the serious car crash of his wife in 1993, but also about his wife. They married in 1983 while he was in Dresden. And no, 2 years before he went to Dresden. And then they had these two daughters while they were in Dresden, while he was in Dresden. She's called Putina. I don't know. I guess in Russian, a woman is called by her husband's name, instead of Mrs. Putin, she'd be Putina. She had told, according to a source, in East Germany while they were there, and she, according to a German spy who befriended her, she told him that Putin beat her and had love affairs. Well, he probably was pretty much of a macho man at home, and he probably did have love affairs. And Putina was rarely seen with him when he was president. And there are rumors, you know, that they were separated. Well, and he's been linked with other women, including this gymnast and an ex-spy named Anna Chapman. He denies the rumors, and his wife's real name is Ludmilla, and they announced on June 6, 2013 that their marriage was over. And another thing about him, I guess it was over quite a bit before, but another thing about him is that there was a story that his daughter was going to marry the son of a South Korean admiral, his youngest daughter of his two daughters. And the other thing is that in Russia, they kept those daughters out of the public eye so totally that most Russians, they say, have never seen even a picture of them, have no idea what they look like if they saw one in the street. And they really had a tight control over their daughters, probably him. But that he agreed to allow his daughter to marry this South Korean. And this is just in October 2010. And I don't know a thing about it, if they did get married, if nobody knows what, but this story was from Korea, and a Korean newspaper said it was true, and that she's had this boyfriend for a long time, and at first, Putin was against the idea, but after he met the guy, he agreed to allow it. So I don't know what's true about that. Now, then there's this Alexander Dugin, who is speaking out an awful lot about what's going on at Putin and so on. And I finally read some things about him. And he's 52 years old. He's a Russian. Born in 1962, he is calls himself, or his what's said about him at the bottom of his article was that he's one of the best known writers and political commentators in post-Soviet Russia, and he has authored political, philosophical, and spiritual topics. He's on the staff of Moscow State University. You know, he's an intellectual leader of the Eurasia movement. And he's been an advisor to Vladimir Putin and others in the Kremlin on geopolitical matters. And his first English language book is recently available. It's called Fourth Political Theory. And he says that all of the political systems of the modern age have been the products of three distinct ideologies, which he calls Marxism, fascism, and liberal democracy, which is the oldest. So there was liberal democracy goes way, way back, but then came Marxism and then fascism. And I assume he lumps National Socialism into fascism and just ignores it, doesn't talk about it. I don't know what's in his book, but he labels the things this way. And he says that the fascism and Marxism have long since failed and passed out of the pages of history. And the first, liberal democracy is no longer an ideology, but just something taken for granted in today's world. And his battle is with liberalism threatening to monopolize the political discourse and drown the world in a universal sameness. He's pushing for cultural diversity, and he says that what needs to be done is to sift through the debris of the first three things, including fascism, and to look for elements that might be useful therein. But then he says his new theory, he doesn't have it very well worked out. He just outlines the parameters, which it says on the book thing, it might develop, and the issues which it must address. He foresees the fourth political theory, which is his wording there, will use the tools and concepts of modernity against itself to bring about a return of cultural diversity against commercialization. Well, that sounds good, doesn't it? Everybody's for that now. As well as the traditional worldview of all the peoples of the world, albeit within an entirely new context. But sounds like a ripoff to me. I mean, a ripoff in the sense of what's new about this, you know, and why give things new names and dismiss the old names and say they no longer apply, but I've got it now. I've got the right way to look at things. And so that's what we get from Alexander Dugin, who is writing a lot about how good the good of what this Putin is doing and how all these nations should go back to Russia. So we'll be back, ladies and gentlemen, and I'll take your calls. I also have information to give about
down in the valley, valley so low, hang your head over, hear the wind blow, hear the wind blow. Love whom you please. Throw your arms round me. Give my heart ease.
Give my heart ease, dear.
Give my heart ease.
Throw your arms round me. Give my heart ease.
Love sunshine, violets love dew, angels in heaven know I love you, know I love you, dear, know I love you.
This valley, they say you are leaving. We will miss your bright eyes and sweet smile. For they say you are taking the sunshine that has brightened our pathway wild. Come and sit by my side if you love me. Not hasten to bid me adieu. Just remember the Red River Valley and the one who has loved you so true. For a long time, my darling, I've waited say that you're going away. How about a mandolin solo? This is the verse that that makes me think I kind of know why the guy's going away. Because she is whining. Do you think of the valley you're leaving? Oh, how lonely, how drear it will be. Do you think of the kind heart you're breaking? And the pain that you're causing to me. Come and sit by my side if you love me. Do not hasten to bid me adieu. Just remember the Red River Valley and the one who has loved you so true.
Take it, friend.
Gentlemen, it feels so strange to, well, my sound level is not very, well, I guess I'm waiting for it to come up. It feels so strange to be talking without my mic in front of me here, but I guess I'll manage. I'm still using this new headset and I haven't had any complaints. I've got to look at the mail. And I haven't gotten any notices from Tan Stoffel. So, all right, here's somebody wrote to me. Yeah, this is a good listener. He says, I heard you very well after a few seconds at the beginning of your show. All right, very good. And then he sent something else after that. Oh, he tells me, all right, Lithuanians are not Slavs. Their language, all still spoken, is one of the oldest in history. Okay, so if the Lithuanians are not Slavs, and I don't believe that the Estonians are Slavs, and I guess the Latvians are not either, they're something, maybe a little bit more related to the Finns, or and then sometimes I've heard these people are related to the Hungarians in some of the type of language they have. So all that I got at one time from Andreas Vesely. But, and he could answer that just like, you know, he knows all that, but I forget it and I have to refresh myself and go back and look and see what it was. And I didn't do that. So, but thank you very much. That was, R. I think his first name is, I should know his first name. Raymond. That was Raymond. That's Raymond giving us that information. He's very good about that. All right. So back to where now I just thought I'd say a little more about and I'm welcoming callers if you want to call in and comment on this 1-830-443-4911. You're certainly welcome to do so, and you can certainly disagree with what I've said so far. I'm anxious to listen to this program and see how my voice sounds with this different headset. If it sounds better than ever, I'll be unhappy because I'm used to it now. I've got it on. It's feeling all right. I could always just keep continuing with it. Now, Hitler, talk a little bit about beating wives. You know, now that's something Hitler was never accused of. I'm sure he never raised a hand to Eva Braun. Artrani woman he was with. They had a more husband-wife type relationship. And I know he wouldn't. And, of course, she would be careful not to behave in a way that would drive him batty, because she didn't want to drive him away. That would be the only thing that would happen. But German men don't do that. German men don't do that. Although I know that back in the old days, that Hitler himself, when he was living in relative poverty there in the big city I guess it was in Vienna, it would have to have been in Vienna, amongst the working class in their terrible living conditions at that time, and that was in before the war, before 1914, 1909, 1910, 11, that he talked about these lower class families, men, getting drunk out of desperation because they couldn't find work, because they couldn't bring home any money to their families. They'd get drunk. Then they would beat their wives and push their kids around or something. And it was a terrible, terrible situation, but it was always after they had been drinking. And then they would be sorry, they wouldn't do it if they weren't drinking. These were things that Hitler wanted to change, because for him, everybody was a German. And that was his thing about Germany, that, everybody is a German, and we all have to have, lives that we can, good lives. We all have to be treated well. We all have to be able to live with dignity. Every German person. So I know that is that idea of just, this is for us and we care about ourselves is very, unpopular now, especially politically incorrect. And, and we have to, care more for others. And of course we also have the white movement. And, as long as people are white, we're all white people are the same. I've been criticized recently by someone who really doesn't matter, but that I say that that we don't, all white people don't have the same blood. Well, we don't. And if you want to say everybody in the liberals say everybody in the world has the same blood. Well, Tan Stoffel did quite a few programs back when. I thought they were some of the most fascinating he's done, because I didn't know any of these things. He brought out a lot of facts about the differences in blood and differences in diseases and so on, that you can't even give a blood transfusion to between certain peoples. Well, of course, he was talking more racially. That's true, is more racially. I would say that when you talk about, when Germans talk about German blood, Russians talk about Russian blood and so on, it may not be as totally scientific as all that, but it's not totally wrong, that there is such a thing. So, nobody wants to comment on this, so I will, I'm going to talk now about, what National Socialism was all about. And I said that it stood for, most of all, racial element, the racial quality, the importance of race. Now, there are people who say the important thing about National Socialism is economic. It had this economic program that got us out from under the bankers and the Jewish bankers, and used a different system, and instead of gold, it was the labor of the people, and that had a certain value. And then you created, by using the labor of the people, you built and created things, and then you had more wealth based on that, and then that led to more and more and more wealth. And I think that's true. That's an important part of it too. But sometimes people want to kind of play down the racial element, but it was, Hitler never played it down, and all the way to the end he emphasized it. So one of the first things that he did when he became chancellor was to pass the so-called, one of the racial hygiene laws. And, let's see, where am I? Well, I'll just say this, that he read about it when he was imprisoned in 1923, when he was writing Mein Kampf. And he decided then that if for Germany to become strong again, it needed not only a lot of things, but it also needed to follow the principles of racial hygiene and eugenics to improve German society. So he had seen a lot of bad stuff when he was, as those years in Vienna that I was mentioned previously. And the facts were, when you looked at when you looked at the scientific facts, and the data that had been gathered, that there was an awful lot of, weak-minded people being born in Germany. A lot of this going on, and deformed people and so on. Well, here's somebody calling, so I will, just so easy now, I will just answer this call and see who it is.
Let's see. Yes, hello.
Yes, hi. You're on the
hi.
Air.
Oh, hold on. Let me turn you down. Sorry about that.
Yes, please do.
Carolyn, this is Bob in D.C. Would you mind if I call you right back via Skype? That's where you get some of those weird numbers. I'm on a short-term phone right now.
Well, what did you want to talk about? Okay. What was your
I'll tell you in just a moment. Let me go.
Well, I hope you're not promoting something.
No, I'm not promoting something.
Okay,
not promoting.
All right.
Okay, here you go.
I'll hang up and I'll,
okay.
I'll call
answer
you.
The other.
Okay. All right.
Hello?
Yeah, hi.
Hi, can you hear me okay, Carolyn? Is it
I
clear?
I hear you. I hear you fine.
Okay, that's great. Yeah, I'm using a headset just like you are. I just wanted to point out a few things. I took notes last November on both Gabor Vona, who was in the Jobbik Party, and then also Alexander Dugin and his relationships. And I'm going to put some of these notes when the show goes up for comments. I'll stick these in the comment section also.
Okay.
One thing I want to point out about the Jobbik Party is they are promoting a thing called Hungarian Turanism. And Turanism, T-U-R-A-N, you can look it up in Wikipedia. They do a pretty good job on both Hungarian and regular Turanism. And what it is, they note their links, their cultural links between themselves and the Turks. So as opposed, and this comes right out of one of the Wikipedias, one-liner. Some Hungarians.
How do you spell? What is this Turanism? Is it T A R? Did you say or T U?
It's T U R A N, and what it really means is Turkism. But for some reason, they leave the K out.
Okay, I see. All right.
Yeah. For some reason, I don't know.
Yeah.
Anyway, this is the one-liner that comes out of one of them. Some Hungarians sought to encourage pan-Turanianism as a means of uniting Turks and Hungarians against the Slavs and pan-Slavism. Now, I'm not an expert at this, but I just thought that was interesting. And that has all to do with the Jobbik Party, so it's kind of an interesting thing there. And
well, it is, and I remember when Vonna came out with that relationship with the Turks, and I've been gotten so busy with certain things that I haven't investigated everything, so I've been very interested in the Jobbik Party, but I let this pass by, and I just thought, gosh, what's that all about? I don't like that. But what it is, it's anti-Slavic then.
Well, that's according to Wikipedia, and you know who controls them. But there's probably a lot of truth to it.
Yeah, I think so. I think it would be. I think that the Hungarians are not that have been kind of anti-Slavic because they're surrounded by Slavs and they see themselves as differently. And of course, they always connected with Germany in favor of the Slavic lands back then. So,
that's interesting. This goes into one of those what we've got to get over type deals if we're ever going to unite as a pan-Aryan or white race. We've got to get over this kind of stuff. There's no doubt about it, and it is a problem.
Well, I know you think that, but I'm not convinced that people can't have these special feelings about themselves.
Oh, I'm not saying that there should be this all-white entity that doesn't have any culture, no. But I mean to use it as something that the Jews can use against us by pitting one off against the other. See, that's the problem. That's where I see the problem.
Well, you know, you always say that, but the Jews can't necessarily use that if we don't let them use it. I mean, just because this particular Hungarian Nationalist Party wants to make links to the Turks as kind of an anti-Pan-Slavic thing, because they're surrounded by Slavic nations there, and particularly the huge nation of Russia, maybe for their own independence or something. I don't see that is necessarily something the Jews can use. But anyway, you go on, Bob.
Well, they use anything. You know, they'll use anything against us.
Well, they will, but of course.
One against the other. Now, the other, I'll leave that where it lays right now. These are notes that I have from last November. I did a show on this stuff, so it's from last November. So I'm a little cloudy myself. I'm going back on it, but when you went into it in the first hour, I figured I'd bring this up. Now, on Alexander Dugin. Now, he is a promoter of a Eurasian alliance, this Eurasian idea, which touches on what I just talked about with the Jobbik Party. It touches on it. They are not opposed to a multicultural situation in which the Turks and whites and others will be mixed in the same basket. They are not opposed to that at all. In fact, they actually may be promoting this. One of the people did an interview with a guy that was supposedly the head of the Baltic Republican Party in Kaliningrad, which is actually Russia on the Baltic. It's a little sliver they have there. And he said they're shipping in Turks, even into Kaliningrad and all through Russia. They're shipping them in, just like they're dropping Somalis, I guess similar to how the State Department is dropping Somalis in around the country here in the U.S. So this is a concern, no doubt about it. But he is a Eurasianist, and this is a little note that I took. Eurasian alliance means geopolitical cooperation between certain Asian and European countries, not an alliance of Eurasian people. That's the note I pulled. And then my question here is: this something akin to Norman Lowell's Europe of the Regions? It sounds divisive to me. Yeah, it does. But
well,
this is
I think that's something that Putin might be open to, because he seems to be very racially tolerant, even though he also wants to improve the Russia. I mean, he wants more births amongst the Russian people. He wants the Russian people to be strong and not to die out. But he also sees probably, I think, the future of wider regions and, you know, to keep the East strong, he sees uniting with all these various Asian countries and so on. And now there you say, I bet that's true about his daughter marrying a South Korean.
That surprised me.
He sees himself as kind of ruling over, or Russia being an important part of this big eastern area, which would be opposed in a sense to, or stand apart from, the West.
Russia itself, to me, is becoming what I call a meta-continent. It's not really a country. It's too big to be called a country, mm-hmm. and it's not an either continent. It's a sort of a meta-continent on its own. It's Eurasia, and that's what it is. It is, and it's something different than anything else we've seen or that we've put a name to. Now, I have further notes here. They are a little bit spotty, but last November, Alexander Dugin did a press conference, and a Ukrainian girl asked him a question. She was way in the back, but you could see it, and I have the YouTube. It'll be posted. And he just said to her, it's up to Ukraine people to choose to be in Europe or in Russia. So even back then, I guess this was at the start of all the troubles about 4 months ago. So this will be there. Folks can look at this YouTube and various notes on this. And then I do have notes here that Dugin is associated with a guy by the name of Alain Debenoist.
Debenois, it's pronounced.
Debenois, thank you.
That all the new right people love so much. Alain Debenois.
Debenois, and I think he's Jewish, by the way. I think Debenois is, but I'm not sure of that.
Yeah, I think he is part Jewish. Gosh, my memory is so bad, I have to go and look.
I got to do the same thing.
I've talked about him, enough. And I think he is, yeah.
Now, also...
At any rate, he's very Jew-friendly.
Mm-hmm.
He's a nationalist, supposedly, and pro-white, but he's very Jew-friendly, so there you are.
So that's a real problem in Europe, and more than a few of these nationalist parties are Jew-friendly, and that just defeats everything. But another contact that Dugin has, I believe this fellow is either a colleague, a simple colleague, older colleague, or maybe even a mentor to Alexander Dugin, and that's Yevgeny Primakov. Now, Primakov was I guess he was the head guy in Russia for a short period, and then they brought in Yeltsin. Or I might have those off. This might have been pre-Putin. I'm probably wrong about that. This is probably the guy before Putin. But so this would have been around 1999. But Yevgeny Primakov's name is, his real name is Pincus Finkelstein. So he's a Jewish guy. So here's a guy who is, and that's proven. I'll have the source for that. And he is very close to Alexander Dugin, and that's been pretty well explained. You know, there isn't much contention there. So there's another problem I have. And let's see. Well, there's quite a bit more here. And I'll put it in I'll put it in the comment section when the show goes up on the website, and folks can take a look at it. But the big underlying concept here is I think Putin is sort of a nationalist from that Russian Eurasian point of view. I don't believe for a second he's a racialist, but I do think he's kind of a populist also in his own way, in his own Russian way. And is he good for us? I'd say right now he's definitely good for us because he's putting a roadblock in front of these crazy people in Washington. But over the long term, I don't know how this is going to play out. As far as Russia and the population in Russia is concerned, I think he really does want a white population to burgeon there. I mean, he's giving tax breaks and things like that for families, and I think he really wants that. But nature abhors a vacuum, and they've got that whole huge country and only 150 million people. They've got to fill out the rest of that country, and I think the track it really bothers me, but I think this is the track they're on. They're going to fill that land with the best they can do, and isn't necessarily going to be white people. Could be the Turks, and it could be something like that. Maybe even Chinese in the Far East. I don't know for a fact. And these are all speculations on my part, but it really bothers me a lot.
Well, it makes sense, though. I mean, because I think from just what I've looked at for this show, that that Putin sees his side as he's on the east. He's with the east there, and it goes all the way to the Pacific Ocean, I suppose, and down, up and down, and so on. And as opposed to the West. And it's unfortunate that right now all of our leaders in the West, the whole West, is controlled by the Jews. That's very unfortunate. But I can't imagine when you think that through that we would say, oh, well, we're supporters of Putin now and we're going to support the East because we don't like what's going on in the West. But we're Westerners. And what's going to happen? What is that going to accomplish? I'm not sure.
There's
are
so
they
many...
going to get rid of the Jews? I don't think anybody's I'm going to get rid of the Jews. I really don't. Nobody, I don't think the Chinese are. I don't think Putin is. I don't think whoever else there is, you know, is going to do it.
Well, from
they
what
all find
I
it
see.
More, I'm sorry. They all find it more more easier and more advantageous to just try to work with them or work along with them or whatever. Go ahead.
From what I see right now is it's the typical fault that, and you can understand it. There are a lot of important Jews in Russia because that's where their old Khazaria is. I can tell you a little bit about that in a second. But the key thing is that I think what he did is he threw some of them in jail, chased some of them out of the country, and told the rest, you can do business but stay out of politics. I think that's pretty much how he handled it. But, you know, it doesn't matter even if you handle it that way, even if you've got the strongest leader in history, sooner or later they're going to chip away, and they're going to do the same thing there that they've done to the West. So it cannot last. It must be resolved at some point, or – the whole shebang will be controlled by Jews then. I don't think it is now. I think now he is relatively independent. That's just my own personal view. Now,
well, how do you think that it could – what do you think people should be doing? What is your opinion of all these people on the sites who are saying, well, of course, one place where there's an awful lot of commenters is the Daily Stormer.
Right.
And they're all saying, well, I'm, you know – great, good for Putin and so on. Well, who can't like what he's doing right now? I like it too. But looking at the whole picture, I'm not sure at all, and I don't like this Dugin.
Well, right now, I agree with you on Dugin too. Right now, by the way, I've heard, it's just a rumor, I've heard there's a guy by the name of Dr. Pavel Tuleyev, and he said that Dugin is kind of falling out of favor. I don't know if that's true or not, or maybe that's just two guys. He's a Russian too, so maybe that's just two guys going against each other, but that's just a rumor. The other thing is that the Jewish aspect, let's say that's true, and Putin is, he's got the political side, and he's allowing the Jews to run various businesses as long as they stick to business. That appears to be what's happening right now. By the way, over at Daily Stormer, there are some folks there that are bringing up concerns. So it isn't monolithic.
Well, I know. I've,
sure.
I've read them. I know that. Yeah. I'm mostly talking today, and I'm going to turn that over, ask you about this, about people who say they're not – And I'm not talking about Andre either. I'm really not, you know, I know him well enough to know that, you know, he's looking for what's best for our people. But, but the people who will say I'm National Socialist, but then, I don't know if you consider yourself National Socialist, Bob, but, then say, well, I'm for, you know, what this Eastern Europe is doing and this, that, and then, and Russians and so on. And that there's so many things that, that they won't go along with that are integral to National Socialism. So go ahead and answer now.
Okay. Yeah, it is. Well, let's face it. There's no, one size fits all in this whole question. And it's still developing. The whole thing is unfolding in front of us. And none of us, I don't think anybody anywhere knows exactly how this is going to end up. But right now we've had a battle, and the crazies in Washington and Israel have gotten their faces slapped, which is good. It's about time. And I think we all cheer that. I think everyone with a good heart cheers that without a doubt. And that's my position is that I like Putin almost as much as Andre does, but with these reservations that I bring up. I mean, there is no save all here. We still have to get ourselves out of the bind that we're in. We can't count on other people to do it.
There you go.
Now, as far as me personally, I am a methodological fascist. I believe absolutely in fascism as a method, but not as a doctrine. And they're two entirely different things. So although I might partake of some aspects of, like, say, Mussolini's fascisti operation, I probably wouldn't partake of all of it. But as a, being a methodological...
Well, see, this is something I'll tell you, Bob. I'm sorry I'm interrupting you. But this is something that I don't particularly like when people will say, well, I like part of this, I like part of that, I like, you know, they're picking and choosing around without saying, well, I'm going to, you know, go with this. Because you have to go with something, and then you have to do the best you can with it.
Sure, but it might not match exactly other people's ways. I'll just tell people what my view is on a certain subject, and, you know, that's it. But what happens in methodological fascism, it's basically the Führer principle, the leadership principle. And it's based on the old thing that the term comes from, the fasces, which was the old Roman axe that wasn't quite strong enough because they didn't have big trees down there in that area. That very well could have been the reason. So they would put the little sticks, the dowel types, around it, wrap it with three leather cords, and in that unity there was strength. So although the number one leader is very strong, by far the strongest, still, if errors are made, the other guys will come along and say, keep them, what we used to call keeping them honest. Hey, you're going wrong here. Stop there. This, I contend, is the problem that Adolf Hitler ran into. He did not have a good...
Well, I know. I've heard you say that. I don't agree.
Yeah. Well, that's fine, but that's my idea. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I've heard you put that out there, and so you're a person who likes to criticize Hitler after the fact, and then mm-hmm. say, well, if he would have done this, if he would have done that. Do you really think, you know, that if he would have done some one thing differently, that everything was going to change?
No, because look at the history of the 20th century. It's amazing that he got as far as he did, and you know that. I'll just a bit of an aside. You know that the atomic bomb was really meant for Germany, not for Japan. But then Russia won too soon for them to use it on Germany. So eventually they were going to have to face up to that atomic weapon somehow. So even if certain errors hadn't been made early on, it still wasn't going to unfold too well. You know, it's a real problem. It's a real problem. And, yeah, you're right. My criticisms are just basically what I've found. And I was highly influenced by Tom Metzger because he brought in the idea that and I sort of went even farther back to 1927 of what happened when Hitler got in bed too closely with the industrialists and the workers, although they were thinking for the workers, no longer did the workers really have a powerful say in the politics. I mean, other people were thinking for them, had their best interests, but it wasn't the workers themselves. And that's when the SA got wiped out in 1934. That's my own opinion. I know it's not, you know, a lot of people disagree, and I can understand that, but that's my own opinion on that issue.
Yeah, I know it is. But what about the racial element? I mean, are you real strong on that, or you seem to be more about the working class?
I am towards classism
and left wing like Metzger does.
Yeah, well, let me put it this way. If anybody even asks me on the street, I'm just going to say I am an advocate for the white working class. That's all there is to it.
Oh, the white working class, not
yes,
the white
absolutely.
Race.
The yeah. white working class, because they really they're the most shunned group today.
They're having a hard time now. And the working class generally does have the hardest time. But does that mean that you're just going to be for the working class and you're not going to be for the whole
race? Oh,
no.
But this is what I think happened in Germany, is that the white working class, German working class rather than white, they no longer had a good input into government, into policy themselves. And because of that, because more of the industrialists took over, it became a life of its own. And I know there's a lot of gray area there. You know, it was a tough – these were tough times and very difficult in a few sentences to make clear the point I'm trying to make. But I totally agree with what you're getting at. Yes, it should be a, quote, fascist-type unity, yes, in which the white working class has a strong voice, but not the only voice, absolutely. But it must have a strong voice, and that's what was missing, and that kind of policy. But even so,
now, what was the white working class going to do differently than what was done? I mean, what was done wrong there? Because of the war, it was good mm-hmm. that the industrialists were included in government planning and so on, that they were cooperating. It was real good that they were.
Well, my point of view is that the working class, any working class, whatever the race, but any astute working class, the leaders, they know who fights the war.
I don't know. Astute working class, and then you say the leaders. So now, first we're talking about the working class,
right,
and then it's really just their leaders that are bargaining. So
you're
talking
when you're talking about working class, you're talking about people who work. So they really don't have time.
Yeah,
in
but
and
the
of
leaders
themselves.
Become people who don't work anymore.
Well, but they're
they
from
there. Then they like to conduct strikes and so on.
Well,
and because
that's
of World War One and so on. Hitler was totally against.
Yeah, but that was the Jewish
allowing strikes to take place. In
those many of those strikes were caused by Jews. Jews in the unions. Many of them in Germany. And that
were.
Was part of the stab. That was part of the stab in the back. But my point is that an astute leadership coming from the working class for the working class will have an aversion to going to war, will put the brakes on somewhat. And we'll never know. I mean, let's face it, you're right. This is all hindsight. But it's what I really do see in the future. I'm thinking, Carolyn, I forgot about this, but this is absolutely true. Everything I think is based on the future. Any criticism you see isn't meant to be something to make a big deal out of it.
Yeah.
It's saying, look, can we learn from this for the future? Can we learn from this for the future? And I believe what must be done is we must have a better secondary and tertiary leadership that we develop through time, that when the next philosopher king comes, whenever, if ever, but when the next one comes and starts moving, that he will have the kind of resources in secondary and tertiary leadership to get things done right. And more completely. We'll never have perfection, but to do better than we did.
You're convinced about these ideas, and I respect them because I know you want the best. But do you think? Of course, I'm just, this is a rhetorical it's a real question, but you have to answer it. Do you think that you can set any of this up, or that by you talking about this that we can create a better system that we're going to learn from, so when the next philosopher king comes, we're all going to be organized and we're going to enforce these kinds of ideas so that we don't have the same mistakes that Hitler made?
Well, I think we're doing that. This is being done now.
Who's doing this?
Well, I was going to explain. One place that it's being done, not perfectly, is Renegade Broadcasting. Sometimes they have some really great shows, and sometimes they don't. But the people are learning things that you could never get before because of the Internet. And it is a central location. Your site is doing it. I'll tell you, Daily Stormer with Andre, I mean, this is just an incredible site. In fact, he just put out an article, apparently, he's even being given fairly good press with some left-wing outlets. So,
that's true. Well, I'm going to have Andre on Monday on the Heretics Hour. And, we're going to see what he can say about all of this. You make a big, I don't know that's what kind of press that is. I read it. I've never heard of it and had a couple of comments there. So I don't know if they're very, don't have much attention there. But, I think sometimes you people make too much out of things. And I guess there's something for being positive, but you just make too much out of things. There's so much dreaming going on amongst these our people, amongst the people, that it's very hard to even know what to call it, what to call anybody or anything. But there's a lot of puffery,
in
my opinion.
It's been a long, long time since we, good people in general, have had a victory against these crazies in Washington. And this is definitely a slap in their face. It's a battle won, it's been a long time since we've seen something like that. This is the way I put it once. I've through over 60 years, I cannot remember one year that was better than the previous year. Now, for me personally, in a few cases, and for a few individuals, but overall, It's been a
slow... Well, you know, it's not over yet, and we don't really know why it even started or why people have done what they've done. It turns out that Crimea goes back to Russia, and that's the end of it here at this point. And was this all sincere? Was this all honest, or was this a setup here?
That's a pretty tall conspiracy theory to say that the West and the East had this set up, and maybe, you know, you could say anything's possible. But you know what? I don't play the conspiracy shell game. Like I've told you, I do not play that shell game.
Why are the people in the West, I don't know. You're right. I mean, I have not, read up on this because there's no end to it. So I'd just rather wait and see how it falls out. Because it's not something that is real, you know, of real importance to the kind of work that I'm doing. I mean, it's not a real, it's not vital or anything. So
right.
I can just watch it and.
Yeah, exactly. Well, the only reason I bring it up is you spent the first hour on it. And I thought I'd add a few details.
Well,
and,
the point I want to make is the point I want to make is about National Socialism, how we, if people are serious about carrying that on, or if you just jump to the next heroic person or the next supposed leader who is of a different mindset, like we're talking about this Eurasia business. And this to me is worrying, and it doesn't fit, you know, because you have to decide if you're one thing or another. And when we think about what is important, what was important in National Socialism, which I still identify with, it's not that important to this new, if you might call it, regime of, Putin.
I agree.
And his allies. Yeah. And you yourself said you found that worrying.
Absolutely. Yep.
Yeah.
But he's the man of the hour. So to speak, and
yes, he is.
Not perfect from our perspective, but like I said, at least it's a battle won against the forces of what I consider absolute evil. And so it's not perfect, but what is, you know?
All right. Well, that was good. I thank you for that call, Bob.
Well, thank you for having me on. Next time I'll do this.
Yeah, well, we really cut through something here, didn't we? But I allowed you to be on, and it was good.
Yep. So, now, next time I'll call you on my little track phone, minute, and then I'll let you know, and then I'll call you the other through the Skype. That's, by the way, when you get those weird numbers, usually it's either a 661 or it's a 011 or something like that. One of them goes through someplace out in California near San Jose, and the other one apparently goes through England with the 001 or whatever that is. So, but that's their point of presence.
Well, yours is 2283.
Oh, okay. Well, that's interesting.
I mean, that's what it shows to me.
Oh, okay.
I don't know what that number stands for, but you're supposed to be your number.
Oh, that's a new one then. Okay. Well, anyway, that's the way I'll do it. If I call in again, I'll call you on my track phone and then call you this way to let you know I'm calling.
All right, fine. I won't give you a hard time.
Okay. Have a good day, Carolyn. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you, Bob. Thanks for calling.
Bye now.
Bye now. Bye-bye. Well, that was a nice call. I'm a hard person to get along with, I realize. So if anybody else wants to call and comment on what Bob had to say or what I had to say, I will answer it. And in the meantime, I was just going to say a few things. I've been saying how I wanted to talk about the so-called euthanasia program, which is better called the race genetics program in National Socialist Germany. And I don't really have time to, but I don't have that much about it anyway, so probably just enough time to say what I have to say to get a start on it. But as I was talking about, as I was saying, I was positive, still a total fan of National Socialism. This is a part of it. And I said the main thing is race, and racial eugenics was something that was naturally a part of it, which has been highly criticized. I don't know what Putin says about it exactly, but I don't know he has anything like that, although he has his birth program. He does a lot of what Adolf Hitler did and as he's doing good things in Russia, it turns out to be similar to the good things that Adolf Hitler did, but I don't think he would ever acknowledge that anything good about Hitler. So that's where we get caught in our we get stuck in our positions, and for various reasons we are not able to move out of them, because too much else would fall apart. So we hardened in them. But let me just say a little bit here about how this thing started. You know that it started in 1939, September. Actually, it was in October, but they post-dated it back to September 1st, 1939, the official day of the beginning of World War, of the war, and the war with Poland, because in a war economy you do things that you might not do in a non-war economy, and it was a simple little letter written on simple document written on Hitler's personal stationery. It wasn't a law. It wasn't an order of the Reich. It wasn't a part of the racial purity laws, actually. Now, what happened with the racial purity laws, okay, is that shortly after, already in about the middle of 1933, they passed the sterilization law, which was called... what was that called? I've got it here. Well, I don't have it here, maybe. But they passed this law for the I can't remember the name of it. It's not up there. Okay, what am I looking at? Okay. Required people with certain physical and mental handicaps to be sterilized. And they had this big board that they went before, and I can't find anything. Okay, here it is. It's not here. Evolution. Wonder what I did. Oh, it's way down. Oh, I got all kinds of stuff here. Because the page was short, I forgot about all this I have here. Well, all right, let me get on this. Because I've got some pictures here and it causes the moving up and down to jump around. The prevention of hereditarily diseased offspring, that was the law. The law for the prevention of hereditarily diseased offspring. And this was what they call the compulsory sterilization law. And other countries were doing it too. I had the list of what things that they thought were not allowable, the reason that people should be sterilized, but I can't, because of these pictures I've got in here, and can't seem to find it. So I'll just say that they've got this propaganda poster, and there's a picture of a couple, a man and a woman, as they so often do, you know, the man standing behind the woman with his arms and holding a shield in front of her. She's holding a baby. And there's a map of Germany in the background behind them. And on this shield, it reads, "We do not stand alone." And it's a poster from 1936. About this, showing that five other nations have the same laws as Germany's law. And then, four, five, six, seven nations are thinking about it, are working on it. And, one of the nations, of course, was the United States, which was the first to have it starting in 1912. And the Germans made a lot out of that. And then Denmark, started theirs in 1929, Norway in 1934, Sweden in 1935, and Finland in 1935 also. Kind of, there's a question mark after that. And then they were being considered in Hungary, United Kingdom, Switzerland, Poland, Japan, Latvia, and Estonia. And this was in 1936. So, this was to protect the nation, the racial qualities of your nation, not because they were, of a different race, but because you would have healthy and, people to pass on their genes to the future generations. And you wouldn't have all these weak ones. I want to find out where this stuff is. But anyway, there was things like, mental, here it is. If you were, okay, the people who should have been sterilized were people who were habitual criminals, and it kind of ran in the family, you know, and degenerates, dissidents, the feeble-minded. Now, I don't know if dissidents is right. See, this is from Wikipedia, and they make these lists up, or this comes from some books or something. The feeble-minded, though, I know, weren't wanted. And who wants them, you know? The idle, if you were again habitually an idle from family of idlers, and the insane, and the particularly weak for whatever reason, what weakness, I guess, you know, health-wise. He had a poor constitution. Now these people were not being killed. They were just being sterilized so that they would be eliminated from the chain of heredity. And if you are a nationalist and if you are concerned with the continuation of your people, I can't think that you wouldn't want to do this. Particularly when it had come about through the bad times of World War I and the Weimar Republic, that there were so many of these feeble-minded and weak people being born. And now there's another, and I would think that anybody would agree with that. That's what I think for. Here's this thing that I'll read. Let's see how much. Oh, I don't have too much time. So there's another poster that shows, and this is famous, probably most of you have seen it. It has this picture of a image of a doctor-like person in a doctor's coat standing behind, more like a caregiver than a doctor, standing behind this very severely mentally handicapped person sitting in a chair. And you can see that he is, but it's so realistic that it's probably a real picture, probably taken from a real picture. Of a real person, and there, and it says 60,000 Reichmarks, and this is what this person suffering from hereditary defects cost the community of Germans during his lifetime. Fellow citizen, that is your money too. Read a new people. Oh, this is from a magazine. Yeah, you're supposed to read this magazine, Neues Volk, New People, monthly magazine from the Office of Race Politics of the National Socialist German NSDAP. So the NSDAP was promoting this. And now this is looked upon today as being so terrible that you would equate a person's life with money. Because they, as they say now, and in fact, Adolf Hitler wrote, let me find that in, here it is, I think it is, yeah. He wrote in, must be in Mein Kampf, no, his second book, I'm a believer in Hitler's second book as being genuine. I have it, read it. I can't imagine why anybody would think it wasn't, but they just don't want him to be responsible for saying some of the things he said about the expansion of the Reich. But he wrote in there, or it's from there, Sparta must be regarded as the first Volkish state. The exposure of the sick, weak, deformed children, in short, their destruction, was more decent and, in truth, 1,000 times more humane than the wretched insanity of our day, which preserves the most pathological subject, and indeed, at any price, and yet takes the life of 100,000 healthy children in consequence of birth control or through abortions, in order subsequently to breed a race of degenerates burdened with illnesses. Well, I think that makes every bit amount of sense. I mean, I know people who have these problems or, you know, or are super sympathetic, think that this is God's will or something, and that if people are born this way, well, that you just love them all the more and you just take care of them at whatever cost. And today, of course, the costs go up into the millions for a single person. Whereas at that time, it was 60,000 Reichsmarks. Of course, that was in the 1930s. That was a huge amount of money. It was a huge. It would probably be 6 million Reichsmark, Deutschmarks today, or euros. But this is so demonized. It's so demonized. And I would really like to talk with people about why they think it's wrong to see things this way. It's wrong to see the good of society over and above certain individuals. And I can't imagine that if you, I think I'm not going to hear this. We have 3 minutes left. Okay. I think if you consider the life of these people who they might seem to, you know, be happy. They don't have enough sense not to be, some of them, but I think a life that a person does not develop into a full human being should not be. I really do. And I don't see them as special, and we just are opportunities sent by God so that we can learn to love things and we can learn to love more and all of that. That's just stuff that's made up in order to cover for it. And you have to wonder why they want to have healthy, useful people spending their lives taking care of super handicapped people. But I think that nature means for human beings, for everything to be at its best, you know, to develop into a fully what it should be. And we know that in nature, things that are I got my 60-second cue now. In nature, things that are not up to par are not encouraged by nature to continue on in life. And animals do this. Animals shun, and it seems so cruel. Well, I've mentioned this before, but animals shun those who are sickly and not right and let them die, want them to die. They don't want them to be around in their grouping. So I've got 30 seconds, ladies and gentlemen, so I think I'll stop babbling on here and tell you again that on Monday, Andre Anglin of the Daily Stormer is going to be on my program. We've already worked it out, and in spite of what I said today, I'm looking forward to that very much and to hearing what he has to say. And he's also working on an article that he might have finished by then. It's all going to be very interesting, so I hope you tune in. I am going by sight here, and my music has started, so good.
Thanks for listening. And be sure to visit Carolyn's website at carolynyager.com.